Welcome to Ballistic Radio, the fastest growing gun talk show in the country. Join us. We're going to explore the topics of firearms, self-defense, and your rights as a law-abiding citizen. Ballistic Radio, presented by Blackfire Ordnance Group, makers of TNT and TNT Black. Firearms finishes so tough, you need dynamite to take them off. Now, here's your host, John Johnston.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, presented by Blackfire Ordnance Group. I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com and get the latest behind-the-scenes info, photos, videos, silliness, arguments, general derp at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Coasting with me, Matt the Minion. Mr. Minion, how are you?
I'm headphone-less tonight.
Headphone-less.
Very weird.
Yeah, you don't have like your Princess Leia outfit on, and it's just making me sad.
Man, but I can't hear. But anyways, you know.
Well, it's, you don't say anything important anyway, so you don't need to.
Although we do need to make a special shout out, correct?
Oh yes, happy birthday to Calvin at Sushi Monk.
Yes. 747 in Westchester.
Yeah. Go eat there. It's really good sushi.
It is.
Unpaid endorsement. So, but anyway, joining us in studio is going to be Chuck Marshall Haggard. Can I call you that? Marshall Haggard? Is that right? Everybody else does. Yeah.
I think you just did, so.
No, that's kind of like David Williams last week. But can I say crap on air? Well, you just did. So.
Three times.
Yeah, I know, right? Hey, just a quick reminder, this segment brought to you by Colt. Colt, the legend continues. So, Mr. Haggard, how are you doing?
Doing okay. Having a good weekend.
So, you made it on time, which I was concerned about slightly.
Barely.
I think Sean still has the record for getting here the latest, but that's way back in season one. So, and thank you, Jake, for erasing the previous computer screen bit about the cat stuck outside with the swollen. Anyway, previous show left something up on the screen. You know, it occurred to me that I have no idea what we're going to talk about tonight because we never did quite discuss that part. So before I invited you on.
Earlier today, a couple of people said, hey, you're going to be on Ballistic Radio. What are you going to talk about? I don't know.
So, we could talk about isosceles versus Weaver, since that seems to be in the news right now, the Facebook news. That'd be a good place to start, I think. And for those that don't know, we're talking about two different shooting stances. Do you want to discuss the differences between the two, and then we can talk about why everyone's losing their mind over it?
I'm in favor of both.
Yeah, me too. So what is both, though, for those that don't know?
Well, of course, isosceles, named after the isosceles triangle, basically, when you look at the shooter from overhead in the little diagrams when they used to, like the NRA instructor manual, you would have a shooter facing squared up to the target, both arms are locked out, and you gain your tension by squeezing in and on the gun and grip. Most of your tension on the gun is with the grip. Of course, Weaver stance is named after Jack Weaver and was named thus by the late, great Colonel Jeff Cooper. And he's the guy that basically brought two-handed shooting into popularity and into the modern conscious for modern technique of the pistol. In that, you have a push-pull effect. You're pushing with your gun hand and pulling back with your support hand, and your support hand elbow is generally bent.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen people stylize Weaver to the point that what they're explaining as a correct, I'm making air quotes here, correct Weaver stance.
We call those bunny ears here at Ballistic Radio because we're manly men.
But I have seen people describing a correct Weaver stance, which would ironically mean that Jack Weaver himself was not doing the Weaver stance correctly.
Right. So, well, he doesn't know what he was talking about. I mean, clearly.
Accolades of isosceles is a more modern technique. We'll point out that you're more square to the target. If you're wearing armor, you get more of a protective effect. You're not exposing like the armpit holes.
Right.
However, I found that as we discussed, that there are like any tactics, context and applicability to the situation is where, you know, things come into play. You might want to prefer a certain stance, but the situation might dictate
something different,
something completely different.
Right. Well, and the reason why this, once again, this is David Williams' fault, because he posted a photo about it and
You and I got into an argument with someone that I assume is mostly a competition shooter, which is fine. I'm actually very pro competition shooting. You've shot quite a bit of competition yourself.
I continue to do so.
Right. The thing that I'm discovering more and more is that there are, for some reason, there's two sides of this that don't even acknowledge that the other side's arguments exist at all. And, you know, the common thing from the gamer's standpoint, and I'm saying this with love because I'm going to call everyone on the other side of a Timmy here in a second, and that's also derogatory. The people on the gamer side of the house seem to really lose sight of the fact that occasionally there are people that aren't mall ninjas and aren't wannabes, that their job is to point guns at other people or get shot at by other people or shoot other people, that have to do things slightly different than what is the fastest, maybe on a stage, or the most technically correct. And then the Timmy side of the house, it seemed, because there was an article that I posted by a gentleman that's very well respected in the industry, and I have nothing against him, but I disagreed with his article, that pretty much said that the only people that were shooting isosceles were garage trainers and, competition shooters that have never done anything or whatever. And I don't know. That seems to be where the disconnect is. With Weaver, the thing that I've found, and we sort of talked about this, is that it's really handy for not projecting parts of your body past cover or concealment, if you're especially in a close quarters environment.
Yeah, it could be. You may have to conform to your cover so that you don't, collect incoming rounds, be that in force on force or in real life. Just something as simple as if you take a carjacking scenario, you're behind the wheel of the car, let's say you're seatbelted in. We were doing stuff like that earlier in class today that I was at. If I have a handgun in my hand and I need to fire out my driver's side window at somebody that's an attacker on the driver's side, I'm pretty much going to be in a very hard left hand, a Weaver towards my left side. And there's no way around that. You can want to isosceles as badly as you possibly can.
I just love triangles, man.
It's not going to work. And it's suboptimal for me to let go of the gun with one hand if I don't have to, if I can keep both hands on the gun. And there's other things out there. There's one, there's a whole system, center axis relock, which is really, well, I've said it before, I'll say it again. It's really silly to base an entire system on it. But if I am stuck behind the wheel of my car and I have to fire forward through my windshield, then something that looks like center axis relock works really, really well with a handgun.
Right.
And that's just a fact of life. I think a lot of people get caught up in, I call it jihadist behavior. They this stuff becomes religious to them, and then they have to fight to, defend their position.
Well, and that's, which is fun on the internet sometimes, but it doesn't really encourage there to be much discourse between the two different sides or much exchange of information. So we've got to go to break. When we get back, and Chuck and I will discuss some other topics to talk about. But right now we're talking with Chuck Haggard. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, presented by Black Fire Ordnance Group, makers of TNT and TNT Black. Firearms finishes so tough you'd need dynamite to take them off. Visit them online at blackfireordgroup.com. So we're joined in studio, live, in person. I know, oh my God, a real human being. 2 weeks in a row by Chuck Haggard. So what were we talking about before? Oh, stupid internet stuff. So we were discussing the two different camps between shooting stances or the various in-betweens. I mean, I'll go on the record. I mostly shoot isosceles. But I don't have any sort of deep-held antagonism towards any other shooting. Cup and saucer. I'll make fun of cup and saucer guys. But because, reasons. You know, but other than that, I'm not too tied to any particular... I could think of more point shooting. Let's not go there. But what's the deal, though, as far as... why is there not more communication between everybody, you know?
We were talking about that at break. Too many people get ego invested, I think, and then they stick their flag in the sand and they have to defend what they've come up with or what they've become ego invested in. People, like say, get this jihadist behavior, and then no one expects a Spanish Inquisition. I'll post on one of the forums I'm on or something like that, and somebody just takes an adamant stance. You know, a recent controversial one is the whole temple index thing. It's very useful for what it's useful for. Sewell position, a lot of people like to bag on that, don't know the history of it or the actual tactical application.
The minions over there, temple indexing is Rockstar energy drink.
Well, that for too many people lack a sense of tactical history, if you will, and a sense of context when things are applicable, when they're not applicable.
Mm-hmm.
You have people with a little bit of training that will learn something and then, like, say, draw their line in the sand. I grew up shooting Weaver. I learned Weaver. I changed to isosceles given my druthers. Any time I shoot is from an isosceles stance. I shoot faster that way, and I tend to shoot a little bit better. But if I find myself with something like a Magnum revolver taking a long shot, you know, 50 or 100 yards away standing offhand.
You can't hit something at that range with a handgun, Chuck.
Yes, you can.
The internet says you can't.
I have friends that showed me how to do it by demonstration, and then I've done it. But I will catch myself sometimes going back into Weaver stance just because, and when I pick up a full size revolver, that's what I'm acclimated to with that equipment.
Well, and the other thing too, and I think that a lot of people lose sight of this, if you spent a significant amount of time training yourself a certain direction, and something else comes along, even if it's measurably better or arguably better. Wow, too many. That was an extra L in there somewhere. Bladder. So anyway,
too, but
you need to consider the amount of training time that it's going to take to retrain yourself to the point of unconscious competence using the new technique or whatever. And that's something else that I don't think people really consider is when something new comes along and they start to think about incorporating it, they don't really consider the amount of time that it takes to actually do that.
It does. I've, like, when I went from Weaver to isosceles, when I went from revolvers to semi-autos during the course of my police career, when I learned a new way to control a trigger on semi-automatic pistols, you have to put the work in.
Mm-hmm.
You have to put the work in. Otherwise, particularly one of the reasons you don't want to get bad reps in and you don't want to learn incorrectly to begin with is because under stress, you can have what psychologists will call a spontaneous recall of previously suppressed behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So
known as the good idea fairy.
Well, it could be that. Hopefully, you know, if you're a Weaver shooter and you learn isosceles and you get into a fight and you revert to Weaver, is that really going to be a harm?
No.
It probably not. I can't think of a scenario where that would be the case, but there's other things that I see people do, like poor safety habits, finger on the trigger when they shouldn't have their finger on the trigger, poor muzzle direction and control that can lead to catastrophic results, which is why I'm a big person in favor of training so you don't learn it wrong from the get-go.
Right. Well, I mean, and that's, you know, finger off the trigger, while that seems like a simple thing, you know, and I've had people comment on this in videos. I kind of do what Craig Douglas does as far as my register on the gun is so high that I'm pretty much on top of the, you know, hood of the barrel on a semi-automatic pistol. And I've had people say, why are you doing that? And I'm like, because it's really hard to unshoot someone that you didn't mean to shoot.
Or, you know, you could shoot yourself. People shooting themselves is rather common.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one of the four safety rules, and I'm a big believer in those. That is the one that I think Colonel Cooper didn't get quite right. He didn't go far enough.
Mm-hmm.
I can have my finger hovering over the trigger, and I haven't put my finger on the trigger. I don't think that's good enough. I think if your finger's not on the trigger shooting, it should be in a point of positive register. Let's say you're shooting a Glock, an M&P, one of the polymer pistols. Your finger should be high enough. Your finger's on metal. You're somewhere up on the slide. late great Paul Gomez used to actually plug his trigger finger into the ejection port of his Glock 19.
Yeah.
When your finger's there, your feedback loop is telling your brain, my finger's in its happy place where it's supposed to be parked when I'm not shooting things.
Well, and I'm going to, and I heard Tom Givens say this at the class I was at, when was that, last weekend? Weekend before? I don't remember. But, and he attributed Brandon LaBeouf with it, but it was, Your trigger finger should either be at work or at home and nowhere in between. You know, it's either going to work or going home, and that's it. Home being wherever you've chosen to register it, and work being the actual trigger. So, and that's good advice. You know, but I mean, honestly, the four safety rules, the other thing too is people, you know, when they start getting sloppy about that one, then they're breaking one of them. Then when they break one of the other ones, which is, you know, happens, I'd like for it not to, but it does. Once you break two of them, that's when you have a big problem, you know. So break one of them, and sometimes you get a loud, scary sound when you didn't expect it. But at least, you know, it wasn't a tragedy. Whereas that's something that I don't think enough people think about. But I don't know.
Some of the trigger finger thing is very, very commonly violated. The it's okay, it's unloaded, very commonly violated. Muzzle direction. That's probably. You know, the biggest gross motor situational awareness thing that people can be aware of muzzle direction and aren't. And I'm a big muzzle Nazi in training.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be muzzling anything for any reason. I've been in dynamic entries. I'll hear people say, well, you know, even, you know, if you're going to do this dynamic entry thing, you know, your military guy, a SWAT guy, whatever the case may be, you're going to muzzle people. No, it's not okay. Every once in a while, accidentally, it might inadvertently happen. But I've trained with Tier 1 guys, and they don't run around muzzling people because they are not subject to the safety rules. They actually hold themselves more accountable.
Yeah, if you do stuff like that on a regular occurrence, you're usually off the team, you know, usually. But as far as... kind of another direction I'd like to go. We were talking about competition and whether or not that's useful. And I'm pretty sure I know how you feel about this since we've talked about it. But why is that even a thing that's argued in this day and age by the tactical guys that you shouldn't go shoot competition because it'll train you bad tactics or whatever?
Well, I think too many people haven't put the work in to understand what a training scar truly is, where they come from, and how to have one or not have one, what it takes for that to happen, the usefulness of competition. And I think, quite frankly, too many tactical people, and I'm making my air quotes here again,
funny ears, Chuck, God,
quite frankly, can't shoot,
mm-hmm.
or they're afraid to put their ego on the line and get up in front of other people and shoot because the timer doesn't lie. And the targets don't lie.
I had someone accuse me of that once, that I didn't shoot competition because I didn't want to get embarrassed. I'm like, clearly you've never listened to my show because I embarrass myself every single week and don't seem to care that much. But, I mean, how do we get people past that? Or do we get people past that?
I don't
know.
It's a very human problem. And you know, a lot of the things that people in the gun world talk about are greater human problems. You know, when people get ego invested into things that they shouldn't be ego invested in, like guns or tools, you know, mm-hmm. I wonder sometimes, do people have arguments on lumberjack sites about what chainsaw or construction guys, do they argue about hammers? I don't know why that is, but
yeah. You were a mechanic for quite a while, Minion.
No, I was going to say, coming from the mechanic standpoint, I mean, there's...
Are there arguments about what wrench is better?
There's, you know, you have the three top brands, and then there's the cheaper ones, and...
It's just as good!
Yeah, there's ones that it's just as good, or, you know,
the high point of socket wrenches,
or you need to have this one, and it's...
Right.
So Harbor Freight is, like, selling the high point of socket wrenches, I'm guessing.
It all depends. It's the same thing, though. It all depends what you're using it for. If you're going to be a mechanic and use it every day, maybe not the best choice. But, you know, if you're not using it every day for, you know, it's not your personal thing every day, then it might be good for you.
I'm a big believer in buy once, cry once, because false economy will bite you in the butt.
Right. Well, and... Ooh, can I cover that in the next 45 seconds? Probably not. This is a really great example. I was talking about 300 Blackout this week because I've been playing with one and liking it quite a bit, and a lot of people are saying all this stuff, and I posed the question. I'm like, so do you think golfers look at a putter and then criticize it for not having the characteristics of a driver? And what I mean by that is people were bagging on 300 Black. Well, it's not very good at long range. I'm like, that's not what it's for. And that seems to be one of the things that the gun people do a lot, is pick something and not recognize the usefulness of it or try and apply it to other situations. I'll get your response when we come back from break, and I'm sorry for pointing at you. I can't help it right now. We're talking with Chuck Haggard. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, presented by Blackfire Ordnance Group, makers of firearm finishes so tough you need dynamite to take them off. Visit them online at blackfireordgroup.com. This segment brought to you by TopGunSupply.com. TopGunSupply.com is your web source for fine firearms, parts, and accessories. True product specialists committed to delivering the highest level of customer support to you. They carry top name brands including Ed Brown, Wilson Combat, Les Bear, Sig Sauer, and many more, as well as premium AR pattern rifles. Whether you are looking to protect yourself, are a first-time gun buyer, or a competitive shooter, TopGunSupply.com can satisfy your firearms needs. TopGunSupply.com, your premier source for SIG parts and accessories. And speaking of that, I saw they've got police trade-in SIG 226s on their website for $500. German manufacturer. So, and they didn't even pay me for that one. That's a pretty good deal on a German 226. So. Anyway, we're joined by Chuck Haggard live in the studio. And to the person that just sent me the text message that wants him to say the word that he said the first episode he was on, no, he's not doing it. I'm not letting him. So anyway, and you know who you are. Anyway, what were we talking about?
Training, I believe. Competition.
Well, and you said what a training scar is and how you get them. Actually, go into that, because I'd sort of like to get your take on that. What is a training scar and how do you get them?
But,
it's not like when you rip your finger. I just gave you the finger too. Hey, look, I've got a Band-Aid in the training scar.
Is that SpongeBob?
It is a SpongeBob Band-Aid. So,
what is a training scar depends on who you talk to, because that's not one out of the Webster's Dictionary, of course. But most people take it to mean you have some poor part of your training or something you're doing wrong. You have a bad habit tactically that you become habituated to. It becomes part of something you do unconsciously, and then that's going to, you know, rise up and bite you in the butt in a real-life situation if you get into defensive shooting or something like that.
The commonly heard one would be the state troopers that picked up brass and put it in their pockets in the middle of a gunfight, even though I'm pretty sure that didn't actually happen.
Well, that has been in you know, the police history been attributed to having occurred in the Newhall incident. Very famous. That was a watershed event in modern American police officer survival training. But to this day, California Highway Patrol says that was not part of what happened there.
Sean Hearn says it wasn't either, and he would be one of the dudes that would know.
Is it possible that it could have happened? I've seen people under stress do things like with semi-automatic pistols. Let's say you don't want to drop your magazines because they cost money, especially back during the assault weapon ban when people couldn't replace their high caps. They didn't want to drop them. Say you're shooting on a range that's got a concrete floor. You know, if you drop a magazine on the concrete repeatedly, you're going to break it eventually.
Back when a 17-round Glock mag cost $120.
Yeah, so
no one
guys
remembers
would,
that.
Would go to do an emergency reload where they're out of ammunition, the slides lock back, they would catch the mag, they would eject the magazine and catch it with their support hand, and then let it lightly drop to the floor or stick it in a pocket and then do a reload. Well, if you're in the middle of an emergency reload, that's a bad habit to have.
Right.
Magazines, thankfully, we're back legislatively to a happy place where magazines are an expendable item. Don't fall in love with your magazines. Use them for the tool that they are. And when they don't work anymore, throw them away. But don't catch your magazines in the middle of an emergency reload, because it's a very bad habit. That would be a training scar. And I've seen people do that and don't even know that they're doing it until we point it out to them. Those are the types of things, the popular saying is practice makes perfect. it doesn't. But practice certainly makes permanent if you keep doing a certain thing a certain way.
Right. So I guess, and the reason why I brought it up, and I don't know how we got stuck on competition, but we are, and that's what we're talking about right now. So deal with it. The argument that you hear from a lot of the tactical guys is that causes training scars. I guess only if you're not paying attention, or if you're incorporating all of that into all of your training, or what do you think?
Can it? It can. Anything that you do unconsciously that develops a bad habit can be a training scar. But the indictment of competition across the board as being something that's like not tactical enough is completely ludicrous. We have some very tactical dudes on the planet. You know, we were talking before the show, Pat McNamara, Frank Proctor, who are still, you know, well, Frank Proctor is still an active duty guy. Pat McNamara, you know, retired out of Delta. You look at Ken Hackthorne and Larry Vickers, they are certainly have a tactical background, and yet they were some of the people that started IDPA.
Mm-hmm.
And every once in a while when I shoot IDPA or I shoot USPSA, I might get a little frustrated with some of the what I think are things that are silly. But what it forces me to do is shoot somebody else's shooting problem. Most people will shoot in practice things that they're comfortable with. It's like the guys I know that go to the gym and all they do is bench press, and they mm-hmm. walk around with chicken legs. You know, yeah. they have bad backs and weak legs, but man, they got a hell of a bench press because they're working their strengths.
Right.
You don't want to do that. In competition, I can walk into a competition and be forced to shoot somebody else's shooting problem. That's, you can find that very challenging.
Well, and I think that's a really good way to figure out what level of mastery you're at with certain skills. And I mean, we were kind of talking about unconscious competence, conscious competence, the difference between those two. I've done that. I've talked with Jeff Gonzalez a lot about that in the past on shows. But, you know, if you have to think about stuff, you generally have less time to process what's going on around you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If the mechanical skills are ingrained and you're unconsciously competent in running your gun, running malfunctions, running reloads, making draws, then your brain, people think they can multitask. No one can multitask. You have 100% of your brain operational. Like if I'm texting while driving, that means I'm driving with like 50 or 40% of my brain. You shouldn't drive with 40% of your brain. It's just, it's not smart, not safe.
Right.
Imagine, if you will, I love analogies. If you have somebody who is a driver's ed student
mm-hmm.
and they're still learning, this is how you step on the brakes. This is how you make the car go and stop. Now put that person in a police pursuit as the driver of the cop car. Would anybody think that that was a safe thing to do, that level of competency with a car is good to go in a pursuit? It's clearly not. But we have people in that level of competency with firearms who don't acknowledge the fact that they're really not ready to run that thing under duress.
Well, and that seems to be, see, this is one of the points that I struggle on, and I'm starting to struggle on it more publicly because I think the conversation is a good one. I'm very pro training. I'm very pro being as good as you can be. But there is an argument that can be made, and I've heard Claude make it before, that there are all sorts of people in the past that with zero training and what most of us would consider to be very suboptimal firearms have successfully defended themselves just fine. So,
And that is completely true. That is completely true. One is relying on the incompetency of one's attacker under that system. Now, the fact that a lot of bad guys are incompetent is clearly when you have the successes. What we don't pick up, if you just peruse like American Rifleman, and I love reading Armed Citizen as much as anybody, because when you read a 79-year-old grandma blasting a burglar, you know.
That's awesome.
That's the way it should be. Jeff Cooper was, you know, very politically incorrect, but you know, he was fond of saying the proper response to an armed robbery is a shot armed robber.
Right.
However, in The Armed Citizen, if you read only that, you don't pick up on how many people have a failure. Maybe they didn't get to their gun in time, or they got jammed up on even famous gunmen, John Wesley Hardin, ended up in jail because he went to pull his pistol on the good guys arresting him, and he hung up his hammer in his clothing, and then he got knocked out and pistol whipped by the guys trying to arrest him.
Right.
So, I mean, we can learn something from that situation as far as, you know, your clothing and your concealed carry rig matching up so that you can safely clear your pistol if you need to, that kind of thing. You know, the non-success stories a lot of times we don't hear about.
Well, and the negative outcomes is Claude has taken to calling them and all that. I mean, some of the other one of the things that I truly believe is that the more training you receive and the more competent you are, the less likely you are to ever need to shoot someone or hopefully even draw the firearm at all, because you just start avoiding those type things.
And if you run into somebody who wants to victimize you, and, you know, and I'm putting my police experience in here, I noticed the most competent people at applying force are often the people who least often have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause bad guys are good at reading victimology. It's like lions at the waterhole. Well, if a wildebeest walks up and he's like the biggest wildebeest on the planet and he's all buffed out and he's got, you know, sharp, pointy horns, the lion's going to be like, you know what? I'm not going to mess with that wildebeest. I'm going to go look for one a little bit more scrawny.
Right.
You know, criminals are good at picking out victims. They're also good at picking out people who are poor victims.
Mm-hmm. Occasionally, they get it wrong.
And they do. You know, Masayub's likes to use that line, catastrophic failure of the victim selection process, mm-hmm. which is something I really like.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's one thing for training. There's all sorts. The other thing, too, is that you're less likely to do something detrimental to yourself or someone else around you.
Less likely to do something stupid. And if you go to court, you're a lot better off.
Right.
With a higher level of training, being able to articulate why you did what you did.
Well, and that seems to be a really big one. And I was sort of talking about this last weekend. There's a big difference between memorizing the answer, I was in fear for my life, and actually being able to explain why I was in fear for my life because, you know, there was a disparity of force and I had no clear avenue of retreat. And I know from my prior force on force training that this is what happens when X happens.
That's absolutely the case.
Yeah. So maybe we'll talk about that a little bit more when we get back from break, since we seem to be coming up on the commercials rather quickly. It's the quickest hour in radio. Talking with Chuck Haggard right now. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, presented by Blackfire Ordnance Group, makers of TNT and TNT Black. Firearms finishes so tough you need dynamite to take them off. Visit them online at blackfireordgroup.com. This segment brought to you by Boresight Solutions. Boresight Solutions offers high-end custom modification services for hard-use guns. See why industry, law enforcement, military professionals have chosen to carry Boresight Solutions firearms. Pat Rogers, Craig Douglas, and Kyle Lamb, just to name a few, have entrusted Boresight Solutions with their personal carry guns. When I'm not busy torture testing project guns, I trust my life to a Boresight Solutions pistol. Quality craftsmanship, improved ergonomics, and amazing attention to detail are what you will receive with every custom Boresight Solutions gun. Boresight Solutions, tools to live by. So, we were talking before the break about being able to articulate why we do what we do, and one of the benefits of training being that we can articulate what's going on. I mean, and you start to sort of see the world a little bit different once you have a more clear understanding of the personal interactions that occur during applications of violence?
You do. The more training experience you have, the better off you're going to be at spotting things before they go bad, at dealing with them when they do go bad. And then in the aftermath, the biggest part of going to court is being able to clearly articulate reasonable reasons why you did what you did. We were talking about the well misunderstood 21-foot rule when it talks about people with edge weapons and it would apply to anything, ball bats, whatever the case may be. That drill was basically invented by a guy named Dennis Tuler, who's a very accomplished trainer. I know Dennis. He's a good guy. He almost regrets coming up with the idea because people have bastardized the idea at all. It was just a simple action-reaction drill to get people to understand why a guy with an edge weapon 21, 25 feet away could be a threat to another person.
Mm-hmm.
It would also be a defense in court, give people training articulation and artificial experience, if you will, through training, why did, you know, because there were numerous cases back in the day. Why did the officer or, you know, why did the civilian concealed carry person have to shoot the guy with the knife 10, 12 feet away? Well, clearly a person that close to you with an edge weapon or a ball bat or something like that, and you are, you know, if you have articulable means that they're coming after you or they're a threat to you within that close distance, they're clearly a threat. But you can't articulate that reasonableness of why you did what you did. Let's say you had to shoot that person. If you don't have the training, you don't have the experience to give you the ability to articulate that.
So when the other thing too is that assuming that you go in and train with people or whatever, and for whatever reason you find yourself suddenly in court, you've got the added reassurance. I don't know what the correct word would be. Most trainers that I know, if it's one of their students that's gotten to the point where it's at trial, are going to come in and defend the training that they, you know, have given people.
And absolutely would. You know, Mas Ayoub's famous for that. I have, you know, I'm not a world famous trainer, but I have, I have gone to court on a number of occasions. I've been certified as expert witness and in district court back in Kansas. I've been an expert witness in federal court and have defended some of my students in court cases, both in criminal cases and in cases where they're being sued. All of your quality trainers, all of your legitimate trainers, you know, your Craig Douglas's, your Paul Sharps, your William Aprils, your
Tom Gibbons,
Mas Ayoub, Tom Gibbons. Most of those guys are already expert witnesses and are going to stand behind their training product, if you will, 100%. If you did the right thing, you responded to your training, they're going to come in and validate why that training was done the way that it was done.
Well, and that seems to be, and this is kind of a bone that I'll pick with some of the newer trainers, maybe regional trainers. I'm not going to name any names, but there seems to be a lot of guys, and I like making fun of dudes with beards and tattoos, even though I am one, but there seems to be a lot of those that are sort of cropping up and are teaching things that they don't have maybe a clear understanding of, and they can't really articulate why they're training people to do it. So, I mean, have you been noticing that lately?
I have. There is obviously just this explosion, this cornucopia of training. Where if it went back in the day, there was Jeff Cooper at Gunsight, there was Ray Chapman, and there was very little else unless you were police or military and you had some sort of official function.
Right.
Nowadays, we have all kinds of guys all over the country. Concealed carry has just exploded. But I do think that the depth of knowledge, the pool of knowledge that some trainers have isn't probably what it should be. If you're an instructor and you're not continuing to train throughout your career, you're doing it wrong, in my humble opinion.
Well, I mean, and you know, I've had this conversation with a couple different people. Why don't you train anybody or whatever? Because I've been to quite a few training, you know, instructor level training classes at this point. I just honestly don't feel that I have a strong enough grasp of the material to be imparting it to individuals. And I'm not, you know, saying that as an accolade to me or whatever, but it's just, I wish that more people would really take the time to learn the historical significance and even the progression of where tactics have come from, you know, which seems to be out of vogue right now. And I don't know why.
It's
not cool.
Recently, I had was on the internet talking to somebody, and there was like this brand new cutting edge tactic, and I'm like, dude, that was like rookie cop 101 building search stuff in 1987.
Yeah,
it's not new. If you don't know your tactical history, then you're not going to have some of that depth of knowledge. And I don't think we talked earlier about context. You know, there's almost everything you do has to be contextual to the situation at hand. What a guy needs for inner city concealed carry needs for, you know, the mission at hand, as it were, is going to be different than a guy that, you know, maybe he lives at a large ranch in Arizona.
Right.
Or, you know, you have a guy that lives in Alaska that maybe he has a bear problem in addition to bad guys. So I think a lot of people are getting into the training field. And you know, not to bag on some of the military trainers, because those guys are phenomenal trainers, but they don't always have the depth of knowledge in civilian CONUS application.
When there's a bit of a difference.
And, I mean, and there is.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I was at class last weekend and, you know, Tom was doing his presentation about low light and all that, and he brought up Charlie Eskins or whatever, you know, and talking about the night shootings and blah, 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 blah. You know, and I've heard of him before and I've done, you know, but there were a couple people in class that I could tell just looking at him, I was, what? You know, had never, and that, you know, this is an advanced instructor level course. And I'm like, how have you not, you know, heard of this dude or done any research about flashlight techniques or how they came about or whatever? So I don't know. That would be, and I'm sure you would agree with me, something that it would be nice if everyone did a little bit more of was understand the history.
Yeah, I agree. It's hard to understand why you got where you are if you don't know where you came from.
And that kind of brings us back into Weaver and isosceles and all that a little bit as far as
it kind of do.
Ooh, circular. So we've probably got another minute or so left in the show. You retired from the police department. Now you've got your own training company. You want to talk about what you're doing these days and what you're going to be doing?
I started my own company to formalize what I'd kind of been doing all along. I'd been offering training through National Law Enforcement Training Center as a defensive tactics trainer, firearms instruction and things like that. So I started my own company, Agile Training and Consulting. So I'm offering kind of customized training and consulting as far as, you know, it's teaching the stuff that I teach.
So teaching a class based off of the context of the end user?
What the user needs.
There you go. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. I'm sure I'm going to have you back out, you know, on the show whenever you are willing to come back out. But anyway, I appreciate you making it in studio tonight. Make sure you check out our website, ballisticradio.com, for past episodes, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe and see you next week.